Wanted to to be a young person who could get some advantage out of this. He didn't just want somebody to do service for him. He wanted it to be an experience and an opportunity where they would get to, this person would get to meet people and make a lot of contacts, and it would further his career. And it was to be a 1 to 2 year assignment, no longer than that. Minimum of 1 year, maximum 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I got the job. So he would like to say I was on the road all the time with him.
Now, and your background is you are a degreed engineer?
Yes, right. I'm a degreed engineer, graduated from the University of Evansville back in 1963, so.
Graduated from where?
University of Evansville.
I see.
In Indiana.
I see.
That was in 1963, and right out of school I came to work at NASA.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like I say, I had been in the test laboratory for about 6 years. I worked for Carl Heimberg, who was the test lab director. Carl Heimberg is the one that put my name in the pot, by the way.
I see.
So he got all of his lab directors and his other key people.
But right out of school, you came.
I came in that.
Came to Marshall.
Immediately, right. Mm-hmm. And I started off as a propulsion systems engineer. And then I was worked on the single F1 engine. Eventually was the propulsion system for the S1C stage, which had the 5 F1 engines.
Right.
From that test stand where I got all the F1 engine experience, well, then I moved in to become test conductor on the S1C stage.
Right. In the selection process, did they call for volunteers or
no?
A selection by lab chiefs,
right.
Things like that. Okay.
No, there was no voluntary type of thing. Mm-hmm. In fact, I did this because I thought it was my duty, and from the great respect of my leader, Carl Heimberg, he wanted me to do this, and so I did not feel like I could say no. Because when Mr. Heimberg explained all this to me, I told him I really didn't want to do it. It was not the kind of thing I was
yearning
for. And he says, Tom, you must do this. You absolutely must do this. This is an opportunity
let me have
that you will never have again. And he said, you always have a job with me. You know, if you don't like it after you do it, you can come back and you will always have a job with me.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a pretty good endorsement. I said, well, Mr. Heimberg, you're my boss, and if you tell me to do this, I'll do it. So it was loyalty,
good soldier type of thing
to do.
Right.
And I think I told Dr. Von Braun that. He asked me why I wanted that job. And I said, I really didn't want this job, and I really don't want it, but Carl Heimberg is my boss, and he told me I should do it.
So he probably liked your leveling with
us, yes, right.
Rather than saying, oh, you're my idol.
Right. And of course, I was in total awe of it. You know,
sure.
I was so nervous when I went up there to have an interview, but he put me to ease, and he always did. So.
What did he say what he was looking for? Of course, I understand this had been sort of
he told me it was not his idea, that it was the idea of these other people,
right.
Because they got tired putting up with him and all the trouble he caused. So
he said,
we'll kind of learn together here, you know.
I see. So he was pretty candid about
it. Right, he was pretty
about
candid.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Crackers, if you're interested.
No, I don't need any crackers. I don't pay. Not with the roll here.
They have wonderful bread, as you probably know.
But he put me at ease the first time I met him. And like I say, I was totally scared to death when I went up to his office for the interview. And I held him in such awe because, you know, I'd always heard about him and read about him when I was in school.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Von Braun and the German rocket team, you know, going to go to the moon.
Sure.
And man to the moon and all that. So.
I guess you had... I mean, you had been around him, but kind of from afar.
I had been around him from being the static firing test conductor, he came to all of our static fires. And he was not allowed in the control room, though. He was behind a glassed area, and so we were kind of like monkeys in a cage, you know, like in a zoo. And he could look through the glass, and he could see the test conductor and sure. all the people sitting at the consoles and all that. And he would wear a headset, and he could hear the countdown and what was happening. But he did not come into the control room and mingle with the static firing test people. And so after we would have a successful static firing, there would always be a post-firing party somewhere. And Dr. Von Braun always came to the party, and he would come around and congratulate the people. And so he was that type of thing. He'd shake my hand, say goodbye, and this and that, you know. Right. Very small talk, but I had never interfaced with him in terms of conducting business. So I had seen him, and I had just spoken to him, but never interfaced with him on any business matters. I was just too low in the organization, too young for that.
I imagine that right there, after Apollo 11, you know, for that period you were with him, things were really busy. I mean,
oh, yes.
Tremendous demand.
Right.
I guess publicly, I mean, but also as the landing missions went on.
Well,
I'm sure business carried him.
I know it was, I think, on one of my very first trips or very early. I went to work for him just right about the time or just within a week after the first lunar landing because I met Neil Armstrong up at NASA headquarters.
Oh, is that right?
And, of course, I was in awe of him, too, the first man to work on the moon. And the occasion was Dr. Von Braun had a meeting with Tom Paine, who was the administrator at the time. And he was in Tom Paine's office, and I had been off to another office of manned space flight or something, either picking up something or scheduling something or whatever. And so I was to meet Dr. Von Braun at a certain time up in Dr. Paine's office. So I come up there in the waiting area outside of his office, and there's this gentleman sitting there all by himself. There wasn't another soul there, and I sat down and picked up a magazine and looked around, and my gosh, if it wasn't Neil Armstrong. And he had just landed, and he was there to have a meeting with Tom Paine and tell him all about it. But he had nobody with him. I mean, he was all by himself. And I was so nervous, I didn't know what to say to him. Like, you know, how was it on the moon?
And when you say landed, you mean landed on Earth.
Yes, he had retired, right.
Yeah,
he had just retired. And like I say, it was very shortly after the landing on the moon. He had just come back, and I think this was his first meeting with Tom Paine since he had returned from the moon.
Did you, so you didn't really strike up a conversation?
I carried on small talk with him.
Right.
Asked him how he's feeling, how he's doing. And I was concerned about his health, you know. And then we just small talked about, you know, how busy the agency was and how that mission's really going to lay the groundwork for the next one. And here we had another one coming up in just 3 or 4 weeks or whatever.
Sure.
I think they were like 6 weeks apart at the time. And so the agency was really, really busy, like you said.
I was going to say, what a way to start your new site.
Right. But
Paine and Von Braun had a pretty good relationship, didn't they?
They were
a very good relationship.
They were kindred spirits. They were on a level by themselves, and nobody else was at that level with it. Intellect, I don't need to that a man that brilliant, with all his mental capacity, was also a great human being. And he was
That's what I want to find out.
He was a warm, friendly, gregarious, outgoing type of person. Not the type of person you would expect, you know, who had his responsibility and accomplished the great things that he did. And the movies that I've seen about Von Braun never captured the essence of the man. You know, that he always comes across as the gruff, very dictatorial,
sure,
German type, you know, and he wasn't that way at all. A lot of them were, but he wasn't.
I have a fair amount of material that goes to that point of what, you know, what a true, warm, caring human being he was, despite his wonderful stature, right?
His treatment of me was exceptional, and he included me in everything, and he was concerned about me. He worried about me. And he should, you know, I told him, just forget about me. Don't even be concerned about me. But every time we would go anywhere, and I would try to fade into the wallpaper, you know, like a wallflower, and slip off and do what I had to do, and be trying to make a phone call or trying to check on some status because we were running behind and give somebody a heads up that we're running late. There this time or that, and he would always stick his head up in the crowd and be looking around for me, and then he'd spot me, he'd say, Tom, come here, and he said, let me introduce you to my good friend, and this happened with Richard Nixon, the president, one time, he was in his company there, and he calls me up there out of the crowd and introduced me to Richard Nixon, the president at the time, and, he would do those sort of things, always. And wherever we went, we'd go to Houston. He would make sure that I met all the astronauts. We would go down in the training facilities. And he would make sure that I got to fly in the simulators with the astronauts.
Is that right?
He wanted me to participate in everything that he participated in. He would bring me into very, very private meetings that nobody else was allowed to come into. I'd be the only other person at Martian Space Flight Center because he could only bring one person. So it would be me. He would always bring me.
So absolute trust feeling of confidence.
Everhard Reese, who was his deputy, would be there with him. But he wouldn't get to go in the meeting because Von Braun could only bring one person.
Is that right?
So he would always choose me to come to the meetings with. So, like I say, he made sure I participated in everything.
And part of that was that he did see this as grooming you for the future.
Yes, absolutely. That's why he always
that it would enhance your value to the agency later.
He wanted me to make contacts. He wanted me to meet people. And he wanted me to experience all aspects of NASA and the agency and what it's all about.
That's remarkable. You remember any other specific examples of his, you know, making sure you...
Oh, yes. Yes.
Fit in and...
Now, you want to talk about some humorous things.
Sure.
Some funny things. He would always be concerned, like if he had an entourage, there'd be a lot of people, and we were going somewhere down to the Cape, or they were picking us up at the airstrip and taking us to the headquarters building, and there'd be a van there. Little bus, you know, for 10 or 12 of us or whatever. And he would just be like a shepherd with his flock, and he's looking for everybody, and he doesn't see me. Everybody else is me. He come find me, you know. And, you know, I can assure you.
Is that where you were?
Yes. Because I was in a phone booth making a call, and then right before, when I get done with the call, you know, I knew we had a long time before I'd get another chance, so I just dropped right off in the men's room.
Right.
Make a pit stop before I go. But,
oh boy, that's...
I mean, I was very resourceful.
Considerate.
I mean, he didn't have to worry about me because even if I missed the bus, I'd catch a, you know, I'd get a ride, I'd call a taxi or whatever. But he was always concerned about me and others. I mean, he didn't just limit his concern to me. But,
what led you to your interest in NASA in the first place when you got out of college?
Well, I didn't have that much interest in terms of me becoming a part of that. I didn't think I was going to take the traditional engineering job locally. And, you know, you end up being a plant manager of a power plant or...
Sure.
Or you work
in the Evans...
Right. Industrial type companies there where they hired mechanical engineers and all that. But there was a co-op student in my class, and he co-oped down at NASA. And so he was really high on the program, and he told a lot of us, you need to come down and see what they're doing. And they are really serious about going to the moon. You know, I didn't think it really serious.
Sure.
I thought it'd be something way down the road or they play around with it and never pan out. So I didn't really think it was that reliable of a type of job, you know. That
I see.
I better get something safer because we for sure, you know, they'll play around with that for a few years and then the program will get canceled.
Mm-hmm.
I won't have a job, you know. I wanted something secure.
Of course, in 63, that thing was ramping up. Pretty good, wasn't it?
Oh, it was, but still, there weren't a whole lot of people in the country that believed we were really going to go to the moon.
Oh, right. Yeah, well, I'm sure that's true.
Even though we were very busy, and we all believed it. And many times, people would make the comment, you guys really believe you're going to do this, don't you? You know, they didn't really believe themselves, but they believed that we believed we were going to do it. And so anyway, I came down on spring break, and I went around and interviewed some people at NASA there, and went into the test lab, and got to witness a static firing on the Saturn 1 stage, and I was on top of a blockhouse, you know, right out in the open, and when that rocket stage lit up, it just vibrated the flesh on my body, and the sound, and it was just the power was overwhelming.
Well, you got,
and I got so excited about that, and I said, wow, I want to work on these rocket engines.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I didn't really want to go to a design lab and work on the drawing board and all that. I wanted to be out there working on the hardware, going on the test stands, and actually, you know, helping develop those rocket engines. So I came right into test lab right out of school. I got a job offer on the spot, and I took it on the spot.
So when you came down for spring break,
they offered me a job right then and there, and I said, sure, I'll come. Never even talked about pay or money or anything, which was pathetically low at the time.
Was it?
Oh, yes. And private industry was paying so much more. And, of course, I didn't know a whole lot about finances back then. You know, I was just a poor college student, and you didn't require much money as long as you could pay your tuition and buy your books. You know,
right.
But, as it turned out, it was a tremendous difference in salary. But had it not been for the overtime, I couldn't have made it. It was so pathetically low. But
I didn't realize the phase in.
I came to work.
Starting engineers with that.
I came to work as a GS7 engineer, and the pay was $6,650.
No kidding.
And typically the job offers out of school were minimum $10,000, $12,000, that type of money. So $6,650 versus like $12,000, that's a big difference.
Sure.
But my boss said, oh, don't worry about it. You can make it because you're going to be working a lot overtime. And it's your pay grade, you get overtime. You know, the low-level engineers
sure.
Got overtime.
So, you know, I recently heard that Dr. Von Braun was only making a little more than $30,000 when Apollo 11.
That's about right. That's about right. He was not a wealthy man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was fortunate that he had that retirement Fairchild Hiller as vice president after
right.
He left NASA. That he was able to make some big bucks there.
Sure. Some sources told me they thought that was probably around $250,000 for starters there
on
Fairchild.
Yeah.
I have Ed Ewell, the CEO of Fairchild at that time, and interviewed him fairly recently, and I should have asked him what Von Braun made, but I didn't.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was a tremendous leap in pay.
Mm-hmm.
But money was never that important to him, as long as he could do what he wanted to do. And he liked to live the high life, but he could also eat at the Burger King or fast food or whatever,
mm-hmm.
drive-thru or whatever, and he wasn't that picky, and depending on what the schedule was.
But he did enjoy the finer things, didn't he, I'm sure?
Oh, yes.
Considering his upbringing, too. And,
right.
I mean, nice French or Austrian restaurant with violins
right.
around.
But you can't do things today like you could do back then. With the contractors, you know,
right.
they can't lavish you with a lot of these things,
uh-huh.
amenities that he was accustomed to with the contractors.
Well, tell me some of the other maybe heroes or surprises that that happened in your travels with him.
Okay. Number one, like I said, he was a very outgoing, gregarious guy. And he had an insatiable thirst for knowledge on any subject.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't limited to space travel. And so, you need to understand that he was that type of person, so he liked to know everything about everything.
I have a whole chapter that's going to be titled something to do with the Renaissance man, that his interests were so broad.
In terms of healing, it wasn't funny to me at the time, but when I think back on it, it was that he was a night person, and he was notorious for not starting early meetings or getting up early.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when we go to headquarters, you're already on Eastern time there, so you lose an hour there. And you must be in these meetings if you're...
Thank you.
I'm doing fine.
How you doing? Thank you.
If you're scheduled to go before a congressional subcommittee hearing at 9 o'clock, you better be there.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be there. And so, I would call them, we would agree the night before, and say, okay, we're going to meet for breakfast downstairs. We just have breakfast here. And we'll meet there at 8 o'clock. And so, 8 o'clock would come, no Dr. Von Braun.
So was this once?
Oh, this happened
the
all
first
the
time.
Time. It happened all the time. He was notorious. I'd call his room, and he would say,
yes, good morning, Tom. Yes, I'm up there. I'll be right down.
He would hang up that phone, go right back to sleep again. And so I would have to go up and beat on his door, and then he would answer, and he'd say, Yes, yes, I'll be right down. Just I'd make him open the door, and then he would finally open the door, and he'd be there in his shorts right out of bed. He hadn't taken a shower. He hadn't shaved. He lied to me all the time. He'd tell me he was ready, and he would be right there. But he would go right back to sleep just as soon as I would leave him alone. And so I learned, you cannot trust Dr. Von Braun when he says he's up. And so I would go beat on his door tomorrow and make him open that door and let me in his room. And I would tag him and get him in, get in there now and take the shower and this and that.
It didn't take too long to learn that.
So that was one of my jobs here, to make sure he got there on time. To those things he had to. And he was a master psychologist. Some people say he was a politician, but not in the sense that he had tried to, he never tried to appeal to the masses like a politician would. He knew who the important people were, and so he was an expert at manipulating people to get them to do what he wanted without being domineering and always making it like it was your idea and not his. He was real good at that. And many times he knew the answers to his dilemma or problems.
Right.
But he wanted you to come to the conclusion and offer the solution.
I said,
and then go take care of
your own, right?
Right. So there would be a lot of funny things about that. And one of the things that he called me in one day about, he was getting ready for the move to headquarters.
Right.
And his concern was he had this Mercedes that he dearly loved. And it was about a year old. And he just worshipped that car, and he didn't want to scratch on or anything. But so his dilemma is that he didn't know how he was going to get that car to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
That he checked with some places.
This was a convertible, was it?
No, it's not a convertible.
Oh.
It's a sedan. But it was his beloved vehicle. And so he considered having the thing shipped by rail car. He had considered having hiring a driver to take it for him. And he could not do it because of his schedule. And he had to get that car at a certain time, and he had a very demanding schedule. He couldn't afford to take the 2 days or whatever drive.
Sure.
And so he asked me, you know, what can I do with my car? I said, Dr. Von Braun, do you want me to drive your damn car to Washington for you? He said, oh, would you do that? Would you be so kind to do that for me?
Is that right? Which he was thinking.
Yeah, so he was all along. Oh, I drove his Mercedes to Washington for him. I went over and got this Mercedes afternoon before I left. And I remember bringing it home and parking inside my garage, you know, and showing it to my kids and my wife and taking pictures of it. Here's Dr. Von Braun's beloved Mercedes. Did you ever see that sitting in my garage?
Right. I bet you guarded it with your life. Well, you did
all
night once on the road going up.
But I kind of gave him a little downer on it because when we got there, why, he asked me how I like driving a Mercedes, how do I like a Mercedes? And of course, I told him, well, I'd really rather have a Buick. That was the slogan back then. I don't know if you remember that, but all the advertisements for Buick said, I would really rather have a Buick.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, that's what you told him.
That's what I told him. I'd really rather.
His reaction?
Well, I kind of felt that way because the Mercedes had a real tight steering on it. You know, you just had to steer it all the time.
Sure.
Whereas these big old U.S. luxury cars, you know, you got some give to them. And the driving that was like a sports car. You turning radius.
Sure.
You just have to really keep it on the road all the time.
Which is probably what he liked about it.
And it had a very tight, hard suspension system. It didn't have that nice, soft, lush. But it was a performance car. I mean, those kind of cars you could really drive. And so I understand that now. You know. It's kind of like a Corvette. You know. I mean, they're just, they're made for high speed.
Do you have any near misses with that car driving it up?
No.
Not at all. Went well, huh?
This is what it kind of means to me, anyway. But, well, I always carried his credit cards, let me tell you that. When we traveled, I carried his credit cards. And I took care of checking his in, checking his out of hotels. I paid the restaurant bills for the dinners and all that. And so I always had his credit cards. And I'd give the credit card. I told him, I said, I can't use your credit card. He said, sure you can. Just sign your name. And so I did. And in all the times that I did that, nobody ever questioned it. I would give him a credit card that said Warner Von Braun. And then I signed Thomas L. Shannon. And nobody ever questioned it.
No kidding.
Ever. And when I went to Washington with his car, you know, I stopped and bought gas 2 or 3 times. Used his credit card. And nobody ever questioned me on that.
No kidding.
And of course, he never carried cash yet. Never had money. So I was always paying for everything. I always had to carry the cash. And Maria and I, his wife, would get together every time. Well, Bonnie Holmes and Maria and I would sort everything out. We'd get back home.
Mm-hmm.
Bonnie was the secretary here, Bonnie Holmes.
And then talk with her.
And so I would sort everything out, and I'd tell Maria, okay, Maria, you know, he owes me so much, you know, $293 or whatever.
Right.
And so she always settled up everything. She took care of the home finances and all that.
He couldn't be bothered with that.
No, well, he wouldn't even bring home, you know, when he was trying to do it, well, he would never even, she wouldn't even know where he stayed, what the amount was, or anything. And so I would always give Maria the receipts on the credit card for the hotel bills and all that. So she had all that. She was the bookkeeper, the accountant, the banker, and all that.
But, and Joe Jones, you know, who was in public affairs,
yes,
has told me too that a few times he traveled with Dr. Brown, and if, you know, if bellhops or anybody was going to be tipped, I mean, you had to do it.
Right.
Because he just, it just wasn't in his scope of thinking at the moment, and he didn't carry any money with him anyway.
Well, they were so happy to have me, my team, Bonnie and Maria. And I talked to both of them, and they were the ones that told me, you just take care of him, and we'll settle up when you get home. You know, don't you worry about it. And so I had open travel logs, unlimited travel logs. I carried my own little book of travel requests. I could write my own airplane ticket anytime I wanted.
Is that right?
And I had open advances on the travel line, so I could just go to travel and get $500 or $1,000 or whatever I needed. And then all I would do is just file vouchers when we get back, you know. But I didn't have to go get travelers to go anywhere. You know, I just had,
well, it wasn't time.
I had an open set of travelers and a book of travel requests. I could just sign my ticket anywhere.
No kidding.
You know. So money was no problem. I just had to keep up with it, you know.
Right. How many days would you say on average per month or whatever you were on the road during that period?
The majority, I'd say at least 2/3 of the time, maybe 3/4 of the time, if not more than that. There would be times we'd be gone for 2 weeks of a stretch. See, he mixed business with pleasure, with personal business. He gave a lot of speeches back then, and he got paid for it.
Right.
They give a $5,000 honorarium or whatever. And he had a maximum limit on how much he could collect per year. But, you know, so he was smart enough, like I say, he worked the system and all that.
Sure.
He would work all these social things in with business, so he had a trip here on business, and then that evening, why, then he'd be the guest speaker at some big dinner event. And that way, you know, he didn't have to buy an airplane ticket out of his own pocket, whereas
sure.
if he didn't schedule that business, he'd have to go buy an airplane ticket and fly commercial air, whereas if he worked as a business, he could fly the NASA Gulfstream.
Sure, I see.
So there was nothing wrong with that.
Right.
I mean, he never made trips up just for the sake of going somewhere. I mean, he didn't make up any trips. He always went where he was told to go when he was told to do it. You know?
I see. He didn't have a lot of personal choice.
He had every choice.
Oh, okay.
But what I'm saying is there were so many demands on his time.
Right.
There would be 10 times more than he could fill in a day.
Sure.
So he would make the selection on what was most important.
I see.
But in reality, he had not a whole lot of personal choice because the demands on his time were so great.
From others, I've gathered that he just was intent on, you know, maximizing his time.
Absolutely.
That, I mean, whether it was business or personal enjoyment.
There was no distinction.
Yeah.
It just kept going.
Mm-hmm.
And I always traveled with a truck. He did too. That was just standard uniform at night time. So
I see.
You had to put on your trucks and go to some big fancy black tie.
Sure.
And again, something humorous. It reminds me of all these dinners we would go to. That before Dr. Von Braun could have given a speech, he always felt like he had to introduce me to the audience. And there might be 5,000 people sitting out there. Big sit-down dinner, fancy dinner.
Right.
And I didn't like him to do this. It embarrassed me. And a lot of times they put the spotlight on me and I'd have to stand up, you know, and acknowledge. And
sure.
I would come back and I'd say, Dr. Von Braun, don't do that. Please don't do that. And, yeah, a little more, please. And the more I complained, the more he would indulge it the next time. And when he would get done with his introductions, if he were the most important man in the agency, then I was the second most important man in the agency. Because without me, he couldn't do anything. I mean, that's the way he would it.
That's funny.
And he would embellish it, and like I say, and the more I complained, he would really get a big kick out of it. He loved to embarrass me. He got a big thrill out of embarrassing me.
Pouring out.
The more he can embarrass me, the better he liked it, you know.
That is funny.
Now, I don't know if you want to put this in the book or not. I'll just tell you.
All right.
It's a little offside thing. Everywhere we went, they always had a hospitality room set up for him in some fancy hotel somewhere. Even though we weren't spending the night. Just some place for him to crash for a couple of hours.
Sure.
A little rest, freshen up, or whatever. And there was never a time that we went to these hospitality rooms where they didn't have a real nice liquor set up there in the bar. You know, they'd have bourbon, scotch, gin, everything.
Uh-huh.
And so part of my job was to gather in the loot before we leave. You know?
Right.
And we would always split it, you know.
Because it was there for him anyway.
It was there for him, you know. And so he felt like it was his, you know. And so that was part of the deal. And so he would always share it with me, whatever, you know.
Hey,
say, what do you need? You need any of that? Say, yeah, I'm getting low on gin. All right, bottle of gin.
So perks.
Right, we would split the loot.
Especially guys living on government wages, right?
Yeah, and then he would be up there, and it would be, you know, like 9 o'clock or whatever, and if he just finished his speech or whatever, he'd come over, and we had to leave very shortly, you know, like 15 minutes when we had to go leave because we were taking the Gulfstream on to Philadelphia or whatever that night. And he'd say, Tom, did you check the room? I said, it's all in the car, ready to go. He always wanted to know if I checked the room to see if they had any booze in there.
Right. Some of his speechwriters have told me that he, on so many occasions, if he got a little honorarium for an article that they had helped write, and that he had maybe edited and put his own touch to, that, you know, more often than not, he would give them half the check or something.
Wow. I know he collaborated with Art Way and some others on some articles and books and that type of thing. But speechwriters, he didn't like his speechwriters, I can tell you that.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. He didn't like any material they prepared for him, ever. And he wouldn't even use it unless he was extremely tired.
Uh-huh.
He would just, you know, ad-lib everything.
Sure. Lyman told me he reworked text, you know, and send it back to
things are going to be prepared,
yeah, a lot.
But on speeches, he didn't have it. He didn't use prepared text. And on presentations to NASA headquarters, he didn't use you know all about the geograph and all that,
sure.
All the majors use, and they can't speak without a geograph, without words on it.
Right.
He never used any word charts.
Is that
his
right?
Presentations consisted of photographs. He'd have pictures. He'd have a picture of a sign. He'd have a picture of the spacecraft. He'd have pictures of the astronauts in zero-G. But he didn't have written words on charts and geographs.
I see.
He did all that right out of his head. And that made everybody so nervous, back, you know, because they never knew what he was going to say. He was unpredictable. And he would not confide in them what he was going to say. And a lot of times he didn't make up his mind until right before the presentation. And Von Braun, if it were something really, really important, he gave the presentations himself. He never let Eberhard Reese or Bill Lucas or any of those type of people, when you're trying to develop a new program and you're trying to carve out an assignment for the Marshall Space Flight Center and you're trying to develop a strategy on how you're going to go to Mars and this or that, he would never trust anybody else to present that.
I see.
And he would do it himself. And he would do it by speaking, so you better have your tape recorder. Because you're not going to have a lot of handouts with all the printed words, so you better listen to every word the man says. Because he had it all up there, and he had it all laid out, and had it all planned, and all that.
Yeah.
And so his presentations were nothing more than photographs and that type of thing.
And then with him ad-libbing.
That's right. He gave all his speeches right off the top of his head, really. His great speeches were off the top of his head. He would take something that public affairs had prepared for him and he'd push it to the side if he was really on a roll and feeling good.
Sure.
And he would react to the crowd and the audience. And also, that was another one of my jobs, was to assess his speeches for him. He always wanted to know, how did it go? How was this? How was that? And he was childlike in some ways because I could hurt his feelings. And I could tell it hurt his feelings, but I had to be honest with him.
Sure.
And so when things didn't go over well, I'd say, don't make mention of that anymore. That's just, you know, you shouldn't do that. That didn't go over well. I heard some groans in the audience, you know, when he said this.
Right.
And so, you know, he wanted me to be very candid and honest with him, but I could tell when I wasn't just giving praise, why it hurt his feelings a little bit when I'd give him the negative aspect.
But he probably took it all in.
He told me I was the only one that would really talk straight to him. I mean, he told me that a lot, too. He never, ever wanted to hurt anybody else's feelings, by the way. He was very sensitive to that.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very sensitive. He never publicly or privately embarrass anybody or ever chew them out or anything. Now, like I say, he was a master psychologist where he would bring them around to his way of thinking or whatever, where they thought it was their idea to begin with. But he would get frustrated sometimes because he had some pretty hard eggs out there sometimes to work with. But like I say, he never embarrassed them or criticized them. Now, he would come back to me and he'd be so mad. He said, "That damn so-and-so, I would." And he'd get frustrated with me because he knew it wouldn't go any farther than me.
Sure. Sure. And I get it on occasion when, not necessarily some heads had to roll, but when some straight talk was necessary, he might turn to M.R. Reese to do that, take care of that, or reprimand someone.
I remember when we were developing the plans for the space shuttle program. NASA headquarters was, each center director was going to come give a proposal to headquarters on how this shuttle program ought to evolve. And what the responsibilities should be at each center and headquarters and that. And so headquarters had given some guidelines and direction to each of the centers. And they were telling Marshall, you know, now you ought to propose this, this, and that. Of course, Von Braun listens to all that, takes all that in. And he has meetings with all the top guys at Marshall. And they discuss this and that. And everybody thinks that they know what Von Braun's going to do. But there's no way he would let anybody pitch that except him. He was going to be the man that pitched.
Sure.
And he went up there, and everybody thought that they knew exactly how the shuttle was going to go and what Marshall was going to do and all that. And he, just to show you how unpredictable he was, he went up to headquarters, and I mean, he proposed everything, lots of options. Everything, the total shuttle program, even the management, didn't even need headquarters. Marshall was going to manage the total program.
Oh, is that?
Yeah, Marshall was going to develop the orbiter.
And
Marshall was going to, you know, train the astronauts. They were going to do it all. You know, he went in for everything, lock, stock, and barrel, you know. And politically, that didn't go over well at all, you know. But he would always go for the whole enchilada on everything. He was a big thinker. He never thought small. He always thought big. And I'm sure he did the same thing on the Saturn program, the Apollo program, you know.
Uh-huh.
That Marshall could have done it all. So that didn't endear him with Chris Kraft down in Houston and some of those others, you know. And there was a lot of animosity towards Dr. Von Braun from headquarters and from the other field centers. They were extremely jealous of Dr. Von Braun. And they were jealous of him because, number one, his tremendous intellect, and number two, because the guy was famous. And most people in the country thought that he ran NASA. They thought he was the head of NASA. And many times he would be introduced as the director of NASA, you know. Or the, and
sure.
And he never corrected him, by the way.
Oh, is that right?
No, he never corrected him.
No kidding. Yeah.
But they didn't even know, you know, that, of course, number one, he wasn't. NASA was not headed by a director, NASA was headed by an administrator.
Sure,
the NASA administrator. But many times he'd be introduced as the director of NASA, the head of NASA, or whatever.
Right.
And so he had that thing, you know.
Yeah.
And people related to one of Von Braun. He was the man behind the space program.
Was he just besieged by autograph hunters everywhere y'all went?
Absolutely, always. That was another part of my job, was to chop things off, because he would never be the bad guy, but I could be the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was part of the act, and I would get tough with him and tell him we have to leave, you know. And I'd just chop off the reporters or chop off people getting autographs or whatever. whatever. And he'd say, oh, no, please, Tom, just give me five more minutes. Give me. I said, no, we've got to go right now. But see, he was always like he didn't want to.
Oh, yeah. Good,
he
good
said,
guy,
well,
bad guy.
The bad guy says I got to do it. I'm so sorry.
Did he ever try, or did he have a tendency to want to, I mean, like going out to dinner or something, want to go sort of incognito?
Or another funny story.
All right.
You brought it up, the Siege by Autographs. He was very recognizable.
Sure.
When you saw Dr. Werner von Braun, you knew who he was, because his picture had been on Time magazine, he was on the news media, and his photographs in the newspaper. And he was a good-looking man. He had a very large head, you know, and very recognizable, his features. He had strong visual features.
Right.
So he was very recognizable, and everywhere you'd go, people would want his autograph, yes. And so we could not go into a restaurant like normal people. So he would pick the restaurant where he wanted to go, and we're going to go there. I would get reservations. And then we would go to the restaurant, and he would either hang out in the car, or he'd hang out beside the building. And I would go in and get us seated at the table, and then I would ask the waiter, you know, do you have a side entrance where I can bring in this party that's with me? Because I can't bring him in the front door, you know, he'd be too recognizable, he'd just call me nothing. And so then I would get seated, and I'd go out the side door and bring him in from the alley or whatever, and we'd be back in a dark corner, you know, in the restaurant where people wouldn't see him. But if anybody recognized him, yeah, they'd be over there wanting his autograph.
Is that right?
So many times I would bring him in through side doors and all that.
If somebody came over to his table or thought they recognized him and approached him, would he acknowledge who he was?
Oh, yeah, right. Well, yeah. Nobody ever act like they didn't think who he was.
Okay.
They knew who he was. They always knew who he was. They would come up and say, oh, Dr. von Braun, you know, I'm so happy to see you. You know, what a great surprise and all that. So he was always very cordial with him and all that. And he would always give autographs, always. He never turned down an autograph.
One fellow, NASA, former NASA employee, told me a little story about we don't want.
He would never believe it. The things that I did with von Braun to make sure he met his schedule. We had a tough time making a plane connection, and it was extremely important that we make that plane connection. We couldn't miss it, and we were running late, and so there was no way we could just go through the terminal and make that plane connection.
Right.
So I had talked to the airline representative, told him how important this was, who I had, and we had to get on that plane. And so we commandeered one of those little four-wheel things that haul the luggage carts. And so I got him, I said, come on, Dr. von Braun, we got a ride. We went out the side door there and stuck him through his luggage in this little thing, stuck him in the back of this cart, and he's sitting there holding on. And that driver's driving that thing as fast as he could go, you know. And he went just right across all the runways and everything. Went out to the plane.
The plane had already left
the gate. And so we went out there and then got on that plane after it was on the airstrip there.
Yeah.
It had already left the terminal.
No kidding.
And so we went in that little car that hauls the luggage racks.
It conjures up quite
Dr. von Braun sitting in the back of that, you know, sitting on top of his suitcase there, wasn't he? He was sitting on top of the suitcase, holding on for dear life because, you know, this thing was not made for passengers. I mean, it was just a little tow truck. That's all it was. But he would, you know, whatever he required, whatever he took, he did.
I'll be darned. Your family, you were married and had children at the time, and I guess
they suffer silence mostly about
right.
your absences, or
right.
but knowing what important work you were about.
Well, I used to. I had just had my second daughter at the time, and I swear she didn't know who I was till she was about 2 years old, because I was gone so much.
Sure.
And then I would come home and want to pick her up and hold her, and of course I'm just some stranger, so she would cry and scream.
Is that right?
And then I would just unload and reload my suitcase. I'm gone again. So I said there was a lot of sacrifice, because my little Jerry didn't know who I was till she was 2 years old.
Who were some of the other VIPs or celebrities that you met in the course of your travels with him? You mentioned Nixon and
Dr. DeBakey.
Of course,
Hart, sir. That's
right.
Another thing there. You know, Von Braun was not a big politician in terms of trying to appeal to the masses. I probably already said that.
Mm-hmm.
And he never had any great ideas to do anything on a global scale to help humanity that way. But one-on-one, he would do anything for anybody that he ever could. Yeah. He was always wanting to help anybody one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
And